Hi, this is Paul. I'm going to try something a little bit different with the Exodus seminar. As I've mentioned to some of you, I've got permission to use 10 minutes of each episode. And right now all the episodes are out on YouTube, and at some point the plan is that they will come down. And when they come down, the videos that I have used way more than 10 minutes of will probably get copyright strikes or have to come down or something like that. And so even before they started putting them on YouTube, I've been trying to figure out how to handle them. And so one of the strategies I have is to deal with certain sections of them without actually playing any of the video. And I thought because one of the things that I really liked about the seminar is they did, I think, offer some good exegetical benefit that pastors can use. What do I mean by that? Well, behind me over in that corner are a whole bunch of commentaries. And biblical commentaries are books that are to help sort of understand the history of interpretation, where interpretation is now. Part of what's been so fun about Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Peugeot and this Exodus seminar is because they are approaching the text from a different way than technical biblical experts, which tend to have their own schools, and I could do a whole video on what has happened in terms of biblical interpretation since the modern period, when in a sense they wanted, because everything is turned into a science, they wanted to turn biblical interpretation into a science. That is a tremendous topic and it's actually tremendously important, and it's part of the reason why Jonathan Peugeot once in an offhanded comment made the comment that a lot of modern biblical scholarship is absolutely useless. And I, as a pastor, learned that very quickly. You could pull off commentaries from the shelves, and there's all this in-house debate back and forth over source criticism, form criticism, trying to figure out correspondence between history and what was written, all of this stuff, which as a pastor is of very little use. And actually a lot of what Jordan and Jonathan in the Exodus seminar have done is of far more pastoral, homiletical use, because people much more live in the realm of the symbolic. And one of the points that I've made throughout this is that preachers, even if they're using in sort of the modernist grammatical, historical, interpretive framework, homiletically, that's in terms of the word that we use with respect to sermons, almost always have to reach down into the analogical, the symbolic, because what we're doing is we're taking these texts and trying to make them present and actual for people's lives today. Now, one of the issues in the story of Pharaoh that very much came to the fore in the modernist period. Now, talk a little bit about Calvinism and the reputation Calvinism has for determinism, I think has a lot to do with the period. There's a great article by Richard Mueller asking if Calvin was a Calvinist, because part of what happened in terms of Calvinist interpretation and theology in the 17th century, I think, was a deep impact of modernity and sort of the mechanical mind with respect to how we think about the way cause and effect and process works. And that has led to, I think it led to the Calvinist-Arminian split. I think it led to a whole bunch of stuff theologically. And then when you get to this question of the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, well, is this unfair because Pharaoh never had a choice? Now, recently I just did Romans 9, where Paul uses that as an example of God's sovereignty. So here in chapter 7, Jordan begins with, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. But Pharaoh shall not hearken unto him, that I may lay my hand upon Egypt and bring forth mine armies and my people, the children of Israel, out of the land of Egypt by great judgments." Okay. Now, I've been doing the book of Exodus in my Living Stones men's Bible study, and we've talked about this a lot. I actually thought that the conversation about hardening was one of the best treatments of this that I've heard. Now, I could play the video, but then I'm going to use up my 10 minutes. And actually, in this case, now in some other cases, I'm going to simply use my 10 minutes judiciously, because there are moments of interchange between people that I think are really cool. But in terms of the question of hardening, the conversation proceeded fairly straightforwardly, and a number of ideas got brought to the fore, and they talked about it a little bit, and they went on. And so I thought, actually, I could reduce this into points. And for me, this isn't a bad way to do it, because what tends to happen is that, so I listened to these the first time when they came out, and I thought, oh, that was good. And what did I remember? My wife often says something like, a lot of times, people don't remember a speech or a sermon. They remember how the sermon made them feel. And that's very true. And so what this discussion's made me feel was, oh yeah, that's a really good answer to this question. But then if I had to get into, well, what exactly did they say? That part was fuzzier, and that gets less fuzzy if in fact you start writing the things down. And that's part of the reason that people take notes, part of the reason people study the way they do. So again, you sort of have, in Vervaekian terms, you have the three P's you remember, and that's so much. You have episodic memory, and I don't remember, is it propositional memory? Episodic memory is so important. So I remember, and because I'm such an audible learner, some of you might wonder, maybe you don't wonder this at all, but why so often I will listen to a video and then I'll think, I want to talk about that some more. And then I have to go back and find the place. And I can usually pretty well go back and find what I'm looking for, because I sort of remember how it made me feel. And, oh yeah, there was other things to talk about. And so then I'll, going back and look at the video, there's a refresher, or I remember a keyword and I search the keyword, and then I can find the spot. Of course, Grim Grizz has perfected this with his Discord community and all of the things that Grim Grizz does on his channel with his branding. And Chad really has that gift too on his channel, Friday Morning Nameless. So back to the hardening of the heart. Peugeot sort of leads in first and reminds us that what the Bible means by heart, the heart is the center of a person. It's, if you distill, now I'm going to be adding words to this, and they may or may not be fair to Jonathan, but this is, when I listen to him, as is often the case, when we listen to something, we sort of fill in with projection as we appropriate, and that synthesis is sort of how we bring it into ourselves and how we keep it. So Jonathan made the point that the heart is at the center of the man, and that's why Moses, he reaches his hand out and it becomes leprous, and then he puts his hand back and it becomes whole. And one of the cool things about this Exodus seminar is, I think Jonathan's gift for this is really on display in terms of helping give us a sense for how the symbolism works at a very deep level. And Moses really is shown to be the master of chaos and order. Moses both brings a people, leads a people into life in a dry land, but also brings out water. And so, for example, when they cross the Red Sea, you know, Moses is told to stretch out his hand. And it's very interesting. Jonathan Peugeot obviously also talks about the instrumentality that goes on in terms of God working through Moses. And we've talked about that in some of the previous videos, that what happens is you have the center and you have the heart. And so to harden the heart means to, see, I'm already bringing in Prager, means to harden or solidify or strengthen the center of who he is. So in this case, what the Lord enables Pharaoh to become is more of himself. In other words, it is not, I'm already bringing in the second point, it is not the Lord violating Pharaoh's will. In a sense, the Lord is an ally and comes along with Pharaoh and says, I'm going to make you more of who you are and who you want to be. So to harden the heart means to harden the center of who he is, making him more so, and in this case, tyrannical and controlling and his grip on power. Now, as Peugeot will say, he really needs water, because he needs more chaos in this order. He sort of doubles down sets his face. There's this great passage in the Gospel of Luke where Jesus sets his face to Jerusalem. And that's sort of the same thing. After that, Prager weighs in. And Prager says, he gets this from Maimonides. He'd love to take credit for it. Sometimes the Hebrew word is hardened, and sometimes the Hebrew word is strengthened. And that really fits in together with what Jonathan Pageau has said. By doing this, God actually gives Pharaoh, affords him freedom. God does not overcome Pharaoh's will. A little bit later, Oz Guinness will say, you know, for the first plagues, Pharaoh hardens his heart. For the second plagues, the Lord hardens, strengthens his heart. In other words, the Lord is helping Pharaoh be who Pharaoh wants to be. Someone might say, I want God to help me be the kind of person I want to be. And in this case, the Lord sort of says to Pharaoh, okay, you want to be this way? I will give you even more strength to be this way. And you will be more this way than you could otherwise. Otherwise, I would very clearly overcome you and you would be destroyed, but I am going to make you even stronger. So God strengthens his heart to make him strong enough to withstand the plagues. And then Orr mentions that the heart is the seat of the will. And then Jordan comes in. I thought he had a great comment too. This is an archetypal story. And of course, for Jordan, Jordan's eyes are always on the mythological character of the story. Now, when I say that, I don't mean that in a way with respect to historical concordism, how this refers to what modernists think of in terms of history, but in terms of how the story functions mythologically. It's an archetypal story, and you can hear Jordan Peterson talk about archetypal stories. Archetypal stories are things that you can't, that they go to the limits. In other words, Pharaoh has to be the archetypal tyrant for the story to work the way it does. And Moses has to be, in a sense, be an archetypal hero. But now, of course, this is so biblical because one of the things that you can see about the Bible is that God, the God of Israel, is the main character of the Bible. He's the main character of the whole Bible. And so the main character of these stories is not Abraham or Moses. We tend to look at them. And again, Jonathan Pageau's comments about an instantiation, there needs to be a mediation. And that mediation is for us. John Calvin talked about accommodation. Hurwitz then points in that from the perspective of storytelling, there has to be a process. It can't be too easy. Now, there's a little aside that I'll just make aside before I get to the big point, because suddenly they talk about italicized. Why are some words italicized? And I actually wrote Greg Hurwitz and gave him the answer to this because nobody there seemed to know. The answer for this is that older translations believe that the meaning was in the words. As sort of philosophy of language developed into the modern period, people tended to have an understanding that the meaning really isn't in the words. The meaning really is in the relationship between the words and how the words function together. But because older translations focused on sort of word-for-word translations. Now, they always had to change the word order because word order in Hebrew and word order in Greek is not like word order in English. It doesn't work at all. So they have to change the word order, but older translations, and some newer ones too, because there's a value to this, especially if you want to do word studies throughout a book like the Hebrew or the Greek, and you can look at Strong's numbers for that, and I'll bring up a text with that in a minute. But word order, or at least word-for-word translation, helps you sort of figure out what do the words mean within their context. And so what they would do in these older translations, like the King James Version, is that when they had to add a word to have it make better sense in English, they would signal that for the reader to say, now this is what the editors are adding. Now, that's really a very considerate thing in many respects, because if you read a more modern translation, like, let's say, the NIV, they use what's sometimes called dynamic equivalence, which is, in a sense, the translation committee is making an interpretive move. And now, all translations require interpretive moves, even by the word choice, because all you have to do is look in let's say, a Hebrew English lexicon or a Greek English lexicon, which is sort of like a dictionary, you'll notice that any one Hebrew word might have four or five different English words that sort of meet it, because you would use different English words depending on the context of where it is, because it sort of means different things. Words have lexical ranges like that, and that's why you can't really just sort of have one-to-one correspondence. But here in this example of a King James interlinear, you'll notice that the Lord spake unto Moses and unto Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh shall speak unto you, saying, shew a miracle for him, then thou shalt say unto Aaron. Now these, I just copied and pasted this from Logos. These little numbers below are strong concordance numbers. Strong concordance numbers were used sort of the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century to help people do word studies with English, because each word would get a number. Then you could look up the number and you could compare the numbers throughout, even if they were using different words in English. So you didn't have to know any Hebrew or Greek, and you could basically do some rudimentary word study. And those are strong concordance numbers, and they are commonly used. And you can find many, it's all in public domain now, so you can find many Bible sites that will sort of make use of them. And they're actually quite handy if you're looking for that kind of thing. Take thy rod and cast it before Pharaoh. Now notice that it, I used the red arrows here to show where the italics are. Cast it. And notice there's no Hebrew word that sort of says it here, but that makes better English. Before Pharaoh, and it shall become a serpent. So the King James editors decided that made for better English. So they added it and they added and. Now before, by the green arrows, I show where and, right there with the vav, there it is. That sort of means and in terms of how it functions. And so that and is not in italics, but the next and is, because the editors of the King James Version want to show the readers that that they have added a word. Now, if you look a little bit lower, you keep going, and Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so as the Lord. Now, I want you to look at that word Lord there in the last line, because you'll notice that it's a regular capital L, and then it's small caps O-R-D. And what that means, if you look below it, you notice there are no points. Those are sort of the vowel markers on the tetragrammaton, on the name, and traditional translations would translate it Lord. Some translations want to say Yahweh, but I think actually the best thing to do is to keep it as Lord, because there's a huge debate in terms of the name. So older translations and some newer translations will have capital L, small caps O-R-D, so that the reader can know that this is the name of God rather than Elohim, which would be God or gods or heavenly beings, those kinds of things. So I just wanted to do a little piece on that. Now, I also wanted to get back to the meaning of this. I wanted to, I wanted to get into this idea again about God strengthening his heart. John Calvin finds this same dynamic in Jacob wrestling with God, because John Calvin basically asked the question, how could a mere man wrestle with God or the angel of the Lord, however you want to frame that? This is what John Calvin writes. More so, it is not said that Satan or any mortal man wrestled with Jacob, but God himself, to teach us that our faith is tried by him. And whenever we are tempted, our business is truly with him. Now, in this story, Pharaoh's business is with the Lord. And so, in a sense, like with Jacob, Pharaoh, the Lord is going to strengthen him with one hand while he fights him with another, but the outcome is going to be very different. Our business is truly with him, not only because we fight under his auspices, but because he, as an antagonist, descends into the arena to try our strength. And that's very much what we see. The Lord is going to descend into the arena to try the strength of Pharaoh, and he knows Pharaoh is going to run out of juice. But the Lord has some other things he needs to do with Pharaoh, so Pharaoh, I'm going to make you more of a you than you are able to be yourself in order for you to contend with me so that all of my achievements can be met through this moment, through this story, the achievements that I desire in this interaction. This, though, at first sight seems absurd. Experience and reason teaches us to be true. For as all prosperity flows from his goodness, so adversity is either the rod with which he corrects our sins or the test of our faith and patience. And since there is no kind of temptation by which God does not try his faithful people, the similitude is very suitable. And now here, God is going to try Pharaoh. The similitude is very suitable, which represents him as coming hand to hand to combat with them. Therefore, what was once exhibited under a visible form to our father Jacob is daily fulfilled in the individual members of the church, namely, that in their temptations it is necessary for them to wrestle with God. He is said indeed to tempt us in a different manner from Satan, but because he alone is the author of our crosses and afflictions, and he alone creates light and darkness, as declared in Isaiah, he is said to tempt us when he makes a trial of our faith. I can't wait to hear the comments on some of this in the comments section. But the question now occurs, who is able to stand against an antagonist, capital A, at whose breath alone all flesh perishes and vanishes away? At whose look the mountains melt, at whose word or beck the whole world is shaken to pieces, and therefore to attempt the least contest with him would be insane temerity. Now, one of the helpful things to know about John Calvin is he not only wrote lengthily on many books of the Bible, wrote one of the most popular books in the Reformation period, being the Institute of the Christian Religion. He was a popular author because he writes like this, and people enjoyed reading him. But it is, and in some ways, I know some of you might think, well, this is extreme. Well, think about the internet. It's the extremes that get popular. But it is easy to untie the knot, for we do not fight against him except by his own power and with his own weapons. For he, having challenged us to this contest, at the same time furnishes us with the means of resistance, so that he both fights against us and for us. In short, this is his appointing of this conflict, that while he assails us with one hand, he defends with the other. Yea, inasmuch as he supplies us with more strength to resist than he employs in opposing us, we may truly and properly say that he fights against us with his left hand and for us with his right hand. For while he lightly opposes us, he supplies invincible strength whereby we overcome. Now, of course, with Pharaoh, this is different and in a sense reversed. It is true he remains at perfect unity with himself. But the double method in which he deals with us cannot be otherwise expressed than in striking us with a human rod. He does not put forth his full strength in the temptation, but that in granting the victory to our faith, he becomes in us stronger than the power by which he opposes us. And although these forms of expression are harsh, yet their harshness will easily be mitigated in practice. For if temptations are contests, and we know that they are not accidental, but are divinely appointed for us, it follows hence that God acts in the character of an antagonist. And on this the rest depends, namely, that in the temptation itself he appears to be weak against us, that he may conquer in us. Some restrict this to one kind of temptation only, where God openly and avowedly manifests himself as our adversary, as if armed for our destruction. Think about that scene at the beginning of Joshua, when Joshua comes up until someone who is the captain of the army of the Lord. And Joshua, don't pick a fight with that guy. God openly and avowedly manifests himself as our adversary, as if armed for our destruction. And truly I confess that this differs from common conflicts and requires beyond all others a rare and even heroic strength. Yet I include willingly every kind of conflict in which God exercises the faithful, since in all they have God for an antagonist, although he may not openly proclaim himself hostile to them. In other words, if you think about the conversation they had about wives as basically adversarial helpers or something to that effect, God is that for us, because as he contests us, his tests raise us up in him. It's the way in which parents strengthen their children by coming against them. That's the dominant metaphor. Now, what is this showdown all about anyway? Couldn't God teleport the people away? Couldn't God have sent a prophet when the tides of government had changed? Couldn't God have, in one plague, wiped them out and wiped out? I mean, he can cause the death of the firstborn in Egypt. He could cause the death of all the Egyptians and just give the children of Israel the great Nile land to inherit. And they then would be a kingdom above the world with the flow of the Nile, because why was Egypt such a perennial powerhouse? Because of the Nile River and its flooding and the wheat. I mean, during the Roman Empire, the wheat in the Nile fed the empire. It was that critical. God could have wiped out all of the Egyptians and given Egypt as the promised land to Israel. Why did he not? Because he had a plan for Israel that is much like this contest, that Jacob was tested by the river Jabbok and he who wrestles with God. Israel will be one who wrestles with God all the way to this day through all of the adversities. And Egypt will wrestle with God. If you read the story through, you'll see that, in fact, through the plagues, faith in God and Moses grow in Egypt. And by the time they leave, they are God-fearers, not so much God-lovers. And this is what God does. The themes are consistent, that God does this so that the whole world will know that he is the God over all the world, that there are no other gods like him, and that at his hand comes what we need, whether that's challenge or deliverance. In some ways, challenge is a deliverance of sort, because sometimes only challenge can deliver us from the imprisonments of our own making inside. Pharaoh has a part to play, and God will make him, strengthen him to play the part that he must play. Israel is his firstborn, and that whole theme, when you get into the Passover, maybe we'll get into it at some point, Israel is his firstborn, and Egypt first tries to kill them, and God says, Israel is my firstborn. I will redeem my firstborn. And that then, when you get into the part right after the Passover where they read about the redemption of the firstborn, well, Israel plays a special role. They are elect. They are not elect to inherit the Nile River Valley and to become that kind of empire. They are elect to become a different kind of empire. And again, the kind of servant that Jesus himself will become, and of course, my God, why have you forsaken me? Recites the Psalms when he's on the cross. The Egyptians will come to a certain sort of faith in Moses and a fear of the Lord, and Israel will become his people. Israel will become his witness. I was making a comment because we looked at the roasting of the lambs in the Passover and how sacrificial that was. Those lambs, in a sense, were sort of a whole burnt offering, because what they couldn't eat, they had to burn up into the fire. And in that sense, the whole nation of Israel becomes, it says a little bit later, so very explicitly in the book of Exodus, a nation of priests. They are the priests. They are the intermediaries for the whole world. And of course, as a Christian, I believe Jesus then comes into that role and becomes the intermediary for the world. And if you follow what I'm doing in Sunday school and in the 11 o'clock sermons, where the Gentiles are unfolded as well. So it's a little experiment of a different way to handle the Exodus seminar. Let me know what you think about this. And of course, I think I am going to do commentary on some of the clips that are on YouTube, and I think we'll stay on YouTube, some of the teasers, because I'd say they're fair game, and then I'll take my 10 minutes that are not from those clips and just have, when I do sort of isolate my 10 minutes per episode, make the point that. So this isn't like sort of running through it and getting all my offhand comments. It's a little bit more structured. I'm sure some of you might like that a little better. I tend to have plenty of rabbit trails anyway, so let me know what you think.